You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest potluck treats out there. We've got a potluck episode for you today. We've got lots of really good questions about JavaScript and modules and the recession and why is this specific JavaScript false? We are going to tackle it. My name is Wes Boss, developer from Canada. With me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Do good. Hey, I'm doing super good. I was telling you yesterday, I've really messed up my knee, man. I got a history of really clumsy injuries, like a significant history of really clumsy injuries. And I've just tacked that onto it by wearing some slippery socks and slipping down my basement stairs and hitting my knee on the shop vac. And I was like rolling around on the ground like, ooh, ah, for like a good 5 minutes. It's just like,
oh, man, that's awful.
I do so much bananas like physical activity and I always hurt myself doing something like that. There was like a time when I stepped on the hose while I was carrying a ladder and the hose turned on and then I dropped my phone and cracked it and the ladder fell on me and then the hose was spraying me with water. Like a cartoon. Like I feel like a cartoon character sometimes. So I need like a protective bubble and I need little kids grippy socks. That's what I need.
Oh man, that's great. All right, let's get on into it. Fred asks, hey there, longtime listener, first time potlucker. Thank you. We want to talk to you, the listener, that you've never submitted a potluck question. Throw one in the bag. We love them. So the question is, when should you use article and section in HTML? What is the difference between the two? What are the benefits that they offer over the old trusty div? I think that sections were nifty because you could have an H1 in each section, but apparently that was never true. Okay, so I guess like at the time, people were saying like that was always the old wisdom is only use one H1 per page because it's like the title of the page or the title of your document, right? Mm-hmm. And then people were saying you could do it. So they link to a thing that says that's not true. So maybe some examples will help, he says. If I've got a single blog post, it seems like article, but if there is an archive page, is each item in the list also an article? Is article only for long form content? What about something that is kind of similar if you squint at it, like a product catalog? Would you ever use an article or section in something less cruddy and more workflow based, like a multi-step checkout or something? So all of these tags, this is what happened in HTML5. They are just, we call them on the show, fancy divs. They're fancy divs because they are the same thing as a div or a span, depending on if they're default to inline or block. There's no extra functionality to them. They're just more semantically descriptive of the content that lives inside of them. So yes, if you have something that is a blog post or a list of blog posts or a list of preview of blog posts, then that's a good use case for an article tag. A section tag, I've always seen it, and I'm curious what you think, Scott. Section tag to me is just a good way to group elements together instead of using a div. So it's kind of like saying like, this is just like an article. You're saying this is content, but a section you're saying, this is just like a lasso wrapper that I use to collect different elements into one single container.
Yeah. And I kind of completely agree with that. Like, I don't think there's anything that I would disagree with that. Maybe just to reiterate, because Fred was asking very specifically, like, should an article tag be used on a blog listing or each item in a listing? And the answer to that is yes. If you have a listing of like excerpts or previews or like individual blog posts where you just have like a heading and whatever and read more, like those are all article. And so that's the way I've always thought about it as well, right? The article is for content that is its own thing, but often content that can be more than one of, you know, like individual blog posts. It's an article. It's a thing, right? Blogs are like the best example for an article, but you could also, I suppose, use it in other contexts like that, maybe linking to a tutorial course listing, but I guess I don't do that. For me, that's the main thing. But if you take a look at any major page, and in fact, I'm trying to think of like a good page, like the Syntax website, right? I might use section to define the area that has the video player, like, or the audio player. The audio player itself is kind of contained as its own thing.
Yeah.
If it's contained as its own thing, that to me is a section. So if we're looking at the Syntax page, I would use that, a section for that. I would use a section for, I don't know about anything else on this page, but I'm using sections for big chunks of content that are really contained as is. Maybe you have like a landing page and part of it is like the newsletter sign up part of this. And that's this whole thing is the newsletter part of it. I would have that be a section as well. We do that on Level Up on our homepage where we have various sections or group content that are all related to the one thing, whether it's the subscription sign up area or it's the testimonials area or whatever. I use those a section for that type of content. There is like nuance there, and some of it is like really based on feel, so to say, where you kind of get through it a little bit, but it should never get in the way of some of the core semantic ideas of HTML, like one H1 per page, having your heading tags be like hierarchical to determine, you know, what's important,
yeah,
and how your content is laid out in sort of like a table of contents style of you should be able to almost look at your H1 through 6 as a table of contents, so to say.
I'm just looking at the MDM docs and they are recommending you should always have a heading in every single section, which is kind of interesting. So they're saying use it more for content, like inside of blog posts. If I were to say, all right, here's how we're going to do React. Step one, that's a section with the heading of step one inside of it. And they also recommend if the content is a standalone unit, maybe use article. If the content represents tangential information, use an aside, like an author bio. That makes sense. If it's the main content area of a document, use main. That makes sense. And if you're only using the elements as a styling wrapper, use a div instead. So maybe I'm wrong about that as lassoing content. But your example of like the video player, like that's not just lassoing content. That's clearly describing that area of the site as the video or audio player, right?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, that's the way I think about it. And you know, in componentized based development that we have today, sometimes it makes it a little bit easier to think about that. Because like if you look at like the Level Up Tutorials website, it's pretty easy to see where I'm using sections. We have a big section that's browse the library. It has a heading, it has a paragraph, it has its own thing, right? And it shows off our courses in a thing. That's a section. Next one, we have latest drop. It has its own heading. It tells, it has a specific story. The story here is we're showing you the latest content. That's a section. Next one, deep learning and great community. That has a very specific heading and section to it. That's a section. Next one, testimonials. Next one, the pricing and whatever. Next one is reviews. Then our community. Those all have very distinct reasons why they exist. And they do all coincidentally have a header that explains that grouping of that content. All right, next one here is from Andrew. Andrew asks, does your businesses suffer from economic recession? Have you already taken or are you going to take any action? And I think the correct answer here is I think, yeah, just about everything is. I mean, I'm sure there are some things that aren't affected by, you know, downtimes and, you know, economic prosperity or whatever way you'd want to say that. But at the end of the day, you know, if people are being laid off, companies are slashing budgets, there's less and less budget and less and less money to go around for things like learning resources, right? And so I've certainly seen data to suggest that our business has, you know, taken a hit during this current time. And to me, it's not necessarily something that I'm going to be changing too much, but you know, it's a good time to remember the solid practices of not overspending and not, you know, going beyond the means of the business. I think I run my business pretty conservatively in terms of like, we're not spending like crazy. We can cover salaries for as long as we would need to. So, you know, there's been definitely data to suggest to us that there has been effect there. But at the end of the day, for me, I'm just going to continue putting out good content. I'm going to focus on the content. I'm going to focus on teaching people things, useful things, because if people want to invest in themselves and learn some new content, they're absolutely, you know, going to be looking for learning resources. That said, you may have heard me say several times throughout the course of this podcast last year that we were going to be raising our rates. Well, we distinctly have chosen to not do that. And then that's not because of we'd be worried about losing subscribers or not gaining enough subscribers. But man, people are hurting. And the last thing I want to do is charge more for that. And a lot of companies are doing that right now. They're charging more. You know, inflation has gone up. And, you know, as inflation has continued to increase, we haven't changed our prices because, man, I feel for people. I'm buying eggs and stuff. I'm doing all that stuff that everybody else is. And I don't want to punish people for the current situation. So, yeah, I've kept my prices the same just to try to be a little bit, you know, nice, I suppose. Yeah,
luckily in a spot where the price of tech has not gone up that much. My hosting all has gone up a little bit here and there. Like, and a little bit, I mean, maybe 20-30%, which is significant, I guess. But yeah, I was thinking about that the other day. I was like, I've never raised my rates. I get people all the time being like, you need to charge $7,000 per course. It's worth it. And then, or you see these tweet threads of people being like, why are people mad at my course being X, Y, and Z price? Like, it's worth it. And like, if you have to plead to somebody if it's worth it or not, then you have a problem, right? I don't know. It's kind of interesting stuff as well. I am not raising my rates anytime soon either. Does my business suffer from the recession? It's kind of funny. When COVID hit, I saw quick, cut down, and then quickly followed by a very large spike, meaning that people go, oh my goodness, the world is ending. I better save every dollar I have, to, oh my goodness, I have nothing to do. I better learn a JavaScript framework. And then it kind of leveled off from there. It's definitely a little slower than it used to be, but I also don't, I'm about to launch one of my biggest courses ever. So it's hard to look at that type of data. Taking action, I'm kind of like Scott, is I've always been pretty conservative with my business. It always blows my mind that you have six bad weeks in the stock market and these companies lay off 20% of their workforce. And it's like, there's so many people, even personal budgeting, I see people do it. They make so much money and they assume it will be like that forever. That is never the case. You have to, when times are good, you have to assume that at some point that will stop and you need to be prepared for that. So I'm always being pretty conservative in that regard.
Yeah. The next question is about budgeting too. So we can talk a little bit about this. But man, I was on Reddit, of course, classic Reddit moment, the other day. And man, I saw this thread that really bummed me out. There's a guy who was talking about his boss's car, which was a Nissan GTR, which the entry-level GTR starts at $113,000, okay? And
really?
So, yeah, the introductory one, the maxed out ones.
Freaking Honda Civic.
No, dude, there's like a 600-horsepower twin-turbo. These things are crazy. But the highest one is $210,000. So they're fancy cars in terms of price point, right?
Yeah.
And people in that thread were like, because one, the guy's boss was a technician at an auto department.
Yeah.
People in that thread were like, I don't understand why people are shocked that this guy can afford a GTR. He makes $120,000 a year. $120,000 a year and you're buying a $120,000 car? Like, that to me is shocking that people would feel that way. And man, I don't know what amount of money I would have to make before I felt comfortable dropping that kind of cash on a car.
No kidding.
Ooh. Maybe that's just me and I've been taught that cars are...
People are on payment mindset. I've always been a buy it cash car guy. And you see all these other people being like, I just want to know what the payment is. What's the pay every single month?
Totally.
Granted, I'm not being, a lot of people need to buy stuff on payment because it's simply just too expensive and you have to get to work. I'm not, don't clip this and get mad at me. But when you're buying $180,000 car, you shouldn't be looking at payments for that type of thing.
There's a difference. You know, my last car was a Ford Focus that I had for 10 years. And I put it on payment, but I, paid it off, three, 4 years into the thing and then had it for 10 years. So, I guess it's a big conversation, but still, it's wild to hear the mentality sometimes.
Our old house was next to a brush factory in Hamilton here. And they had two shifts of workers coming in and out every day, making brushes on the assembly line. And I got to know the owner pretty well, because like we were chatting and whatnot. And like, it's funny because he drove like a 15-year-old Saab or like a clapped out pickup truck. And then when he would come on weekends, he'd pull up in a Tesla or he had several of the cars. And like, he's not an idiot. He's not driving a freaking GTR like while his employees have to work 10 hours wearing a mask, you know, like he kind of knows, like you don't make your employees mad by showing them that type of stuff that doesn't motivate them to work for you.
Yeah, that's always weird. It's like here's the boss's spot and he's pulling up in a Rolls Royce or something. Like, yeah, that's not right to me. I would rather pay my employees that monthly thing that you're putting towards that car. Okay, so to go along kind of with the money theme here, next question is from Kutz and Kaplan, and he asks, how do you manage your money? Do you use a software ledger, CLI, YNAB, or do you not manage it at all? Are you familiar with plaintextaccounting.org? We've been talking in the past about maybe doing like a money-themed show at some point just to talk about like our philosophies about that. But I'd never, ever heard of this plaintextaccounting.org, which seems like a very developer way to do. You know, I'm going to tell you right now, I do not have the patience for a CLI-based way to manage my money or anything like this. This looks a little bit more like okay, I was a little bit cautious on even doing Home Assistant, which felt like it was too much time to do. But like with money stuff, for me, I want it to be as simple as possible, because if it's not, I'm not going to use it and I need to use it or else you just don't have that type of visibility. So I budget. We used to do it on our own spreadsheet, which was nice because Courtney and I would sit down like on every other Sunday and just go over the budget and do it all by hand. And then that was fine. But then when you have kids, it's kind of unattainable. So I did move to YNAB last year. And YNAB, well, I actually used Personal Capital for a little while for that, and it was fine, but it's not really budget focused. And YNAB is interesting because it takes a different mindset, where like normal budgeting software, you're like, all right, I have X amount to spend. It categorizes your expenditures and like shows you how much more you have to spend in each of those categories. And then you basically say, all right, based on my paycheck, here's what I'm, you know, first you take care of your fixed expenditures, then you take care of everything else that, you know, whatever extra stuff, whether for entertainment, streaming services, that type of deal. But with YNAB, you have like a buckets and you're putting money into buckets and you're basically assigning money to things before you're spending it, rather than saying, here's how much money I have to spend here. It's like I have like an emergency fund bucket that's not a separate account, but YNAB kind of shows it to me as if that emergency fund is a separate account. And that way, if I want to say, I want my emergency fund to be this filled by this date, it can tell me exactly how much I need to put in each month to get that. So that money is almost accounted for before I'm even spending it.
Yeah.
And YNAB is neat, but the software isn't as awesome as I would like it. So I'm in the process of trying a new one. You know me, I'm always trying new things. And the new one I'm trying right now is called Copilot, which Copilot.money is the URL, which is a great URL, is probably the most beautiful app I've used in terms of tracking your finances. So if you're the type of person who's motivated by like the beauty of an app, or if you just want to check this gorgeous app out, just install and check out the demo mode. This thing's really nice because it handles everything, whether that's your savings accounts, your retirement account, investment stuff. You can check it all that. It has like really good budgeting software, but it has some neat features. Like, one, it does like authenticating into Amazon and categorizing your Amazon purchases for you. So a lot of other budgeting softwares will just say, oh, it's an Amazon purchase. Then you got to go look it up and see like what it was that you bought. And this can tell you, oh, this thing was this, and like this was groceries or whatever that you can automatically categorize.
Handy. That's like when you buy Tylenol or makeup at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, that wasn't food. But,
right.
You know,
that shouldn't be counted as groceries. And I will not have that ruin my grocery budget. But yeah, no, I like this app. So if you haven't heard of this one, give it a try. I don't know. Android people, I'm sorry. It's for Mac and iPhone. I'm so sorry. But if you have a Mac, you can use it, because there's a really nice desktop app for it as well. So there's that.
Awesome. My budgeting is just being Dutch. I nice. Have like a pretty good dial on incoming and outgoing and review things, but I don't have, I got a couple spreadsheets as well, but no.
You know where things should be.
Yeah. Yeah. No system like this. And often my, like my wife will say like, all right, like, I want to buy this and we'll talk about it. And if it's like, all right, well, how much should we spend last month on like house stuff or clothes or things like that? And so I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. One thing that is handy is like, a little money tip that people don't often think about is like, how many streaming services are you connecting to? Like, you know, HBO Max and all this, all their stuff, right? And how often are you actually watching those? So like what Courtney and I will do is we rotate them. This month we're doing HBO Max and we'll catch up the HBO shows that came out. And then next month we'll do this and we'll catch up on all the shows that were for that. And then that way we're not paying for, you know, more than one or two of them at a time. Cause it's like, how you can't watch all the stuff on all of them all the time.
All right. Next question we have here is from Raja. I'm confused about all the module loaders in JS. What should I consider using? There's a lot of options. We have CommonJS, AMD, UMD, ESM. And then there are things like SystemJS and RequireJS. How do they come into the picture? I'm so confused. All right. So a module is a way for you to package and modularize your JavaScript so that you're not just dumping all of your JavaScript into one file and you can, there's a lot of benefits to it. Basically just keeping things in scope, being able to share code, being able to trim code that you're not using, all that type of stuff. And there are many different ways to write modules. Back in the day, we had AMD and UMD. That's a synchronous module definition, and UMD was unified. Let me look it up. Universal module definition, which is funny that it's universal and we have four plus different ways to define modules. So those were big in the jQuery days where we started writing applications that were getting larger and larger and larger. And before jQuery, or sorry, before that, we kind of just like, all right, load jQuery on the page, then load all your plugins, then load all of your JavaScript. And it must go in this order because the code that comes after it is assuming that the code before it is there. And that gets out of hand really quickly because you end up just loading literally everything on every single page. So you hope everything is available to everyone. Now with modules, you can say, all right, well, like I need this thing. So I'm just going to, it's called dependency injection. I want to import this dependency before I can go ahead and use it. And that makes things a lot easier because you just need to import the things that you need for those specific pages or those specific applications. So AMD, UMD, those are still popular, but not just because of legacy reasons. So I probably would not even care about those types of things anymore unless you're specifically using something. I was actually, this morning I was looking at Bower. Remember Bower?
Oh, yeah.
Bower
I,
was
do
like
a, I? Yeah. I love that you know, logo.
It was the like front end package manager and you could like NPM install jQuery and like Flickity and like what were the other like popular things that you could Bower install. They were all front end packages. And before we realized, oh, we can just put front end packages in NPM as well. So Bower has kind of gone, it's still being maintained and it's hilarious. They've got tons of sponsors still.
Oh yeah. 420 coupon codes. That's a big time sponsor right there. Yeah. Sorry. No shade intended on that one, but it's the sponsor list is a little interesting.
There's a lot of sponsors that have nothing to do with tech. And they're just sponsoring it so they can get the link back, the SEO juice out of it, which is hilarious. But somebody is still maintaining Bower and making sure that it runs because it's legacy projects need it to go. Anyways, Bower is not used anymore either. So what should you be using? The other two we have are CommonJS and ES modules. So CommonJS was the Node way that we wrote things. ES modules was the new spec. And often people would write code in CommonJS and then you can compile it to AMD or UMD and then use libraries like SystemJS or RequireJS to actually load all of those dependencies in. Thankfully, we don't have to worry about that anymore. The answer today is use ES modules as much as you possibly can. You will still encounter things that use CommonJS because that was the system for 10, 15 years. And I actually just yesterday, I've pushed my last commit converting my entire code base from CommonJS over to ES modules. And we'll have a whole show on how to do that. But this sounds very confusing, but it's much easier now. Just use ES modules because you can import CommonJS modules and into it and almost never, actually, I'm going to say I've never run into the situation where I need to import a AMD or UMD module.
Yeah, and it is for people, anybody complaining about today, it's been a wild time. I remember being introduced to Bower and at first being like, man, I sure heck don't understand why I need this. Because at the time you were just like, let's go to jQuery.com. Let's click the download button. Let's drag the folder into our project and then let's use the files that way or whatever. That was just the way you did it. And little did we know, or little did I know, I don't want to speak for anybody else, that was like just a precursor to the world that we'd be living in. And honestly, I don't know how we all survived doing it the drag and drop method, but hey, we did it. I guess it was because we had like one dependency with no child dependencies rather than 10 billion child dependencies.
It's just zip file. You know what? No, what really made it work is that the fact that jQuery failed silently, meaning that if it didn't find anything in the selector, then it didn't do anything else. And then it just worked. Yep. And you could write code and run code on every single page and you would really not have any errors because there's no checking if the thing exists or whatnot. And that was, that was a wild time. It was a good time.
It was a wild time. Next is the developing engineer asks, hi, Wes and Scott, love the show. At work, there is a debate right now with the difference between a software developer and a software engineer. Some saying you need a degree to be an engineer. My opinion is a developer is one who can complete a task to build a product like changing the color of a button. An engineer takes the requirements and creates tasks, then does the tasks to complete it. In the same example, the requirement being how to increase visibility on the call to action. What do you think? I think it does not matter. I don't mean to like minimize this argument, but you know, I think some people who go to computer engineering school, they feel like someone who didn't shouldn't necessarily be getting the same title as you or whatever. But I just don't think, me personally, that how you've gained your education or what you're actually working on really matters in terms of that title that you're getting. What matters is that you're able to do the work. It's the difference between a developer and an engineer. In my mind, absolutely nothing. And in fact, my first job title was something like digital producer. So like it's all words for the same thing. Are you developing or are you engineering? I personally just think as long as you're writing code, you're an engineer, you're a developer. Doesn't matter. Maybe you're a producer. All of those above. I don't think there's a hard line difference there in any sort of way.
In Canada, there's a very clear distinction. Claiming to be an engineer in Canada when you do not have a professional distinction from an accredited university is against the law.
That's wild.
So yeah. See, you literally, I don't call myself an engineer because you go to jail if you do that. And engineers here in Canada get a pinky ring that is made out of iron. And it's funny. Sometimes you see TikToks of people with pinky rings. Everyone's like, what's with that stupid pinky ring? And it's just like, it's an engineer. That's how you know you went through all the drinking that it takes to become an engineer. Yeah. In Canada.
when you first said that you get a pinky ring for that, I thought you were making like a joke, like flourish the pinky kind of, you know, just, I thought that's wild to me.
Yeah. Look it up. Engineer. Like my roommate in college was an aerospace engineer and he actually doesn't wear the pinky ring, nor does he wear it was like big engineering culture to, you get like a leather jacket during frosh. And then you kick the jacket around a week, anywhere you go, you kick it. And then you wear this like scraped up leather jacket for 4 years around. And it's funny because sometimes you see people walking around like with like you University of Waterloo engineering, like 67.
Yeah.
First of all, congrats that still fits you.
Yeah. Dude, you got to be an engineer to fit that thing on. You got to engineer it to work.
I should say, though, that like titles do matter to a lot of people, especially when you're in a company. I was talking to someone the other day, and they're talking to me like they have junior, senior, staff, and like they had all these like words for
yeah.
That matters to a lot of people because that's what your pay is based on and whatnot. But
I can see that
a lot of times these doesn't matter.
Sorry, I think it is company dependent. Like I said, I was called a digital producer at one of my companies, and that's just what they call developers. I don't call myself an engineer because my dad was an engineer, and he has patents on sunroofs. So he has designed sunroofs. That to me is an engineer. And so it's all like, I think like you said, it's all based on your environment and whatever. And your environment, it's a actual, you know, hard distinction. And my environment, it's something that I don't know. It's weird to me.
Next question we have here from Stefan. Hello, Wes and Scott. Can you tell me about how you handle payment for your course platforms, especially subscriptions is of interest to me. I've looked into Paddle and Stripe and they are handling payments quite differently, especially for taxes. Paddle is a merchant and all the customers are theirs, not yours. Whereas with Stripe, the customers are directly yours. How do you handle tax for other countries? Yes, this is... there's a lot of people that use Paddle and Gumroad and whatever because you do not have to worry about taxes in any countries if that is the case, because the company is doing it on behalf of you and they simply just cut you a check and they take care of all the taxes around the world and whatnot. So that's pretty nice. For me in Canada, it's not super complicated, but it's not super easy. Basically what I do is I only have one-time payment, which is significantly simpler than what Scott has. And I just sell the course for a single price. And then for every single province and territory in Canada, I eat the taxes, meaning that, on their bill, it will say, there'll be a little line item that says you live in Ontario, there's 13% included in the price of this. And then I have to remit those taxes on behalf of the provinces, on behalf of those people. So it's somewhat complicated, not nearly as complicated as some of the EU stuff, I know.
I'll talk about the technical aspects of how we do it. And then the tax stuff outside of that is all handled by our accountants. We don't put the burden of any of the tax stuff on the users. The users just pay, and then our accountants do the rest. they have all the merchant fees and all that stuff get taken out and everything. So, but technically what we do is we use Braintree, so not Paddle or Stripe, but a lot of these function very similar. Technically, what we do is we first use Node to hit Braintree with our API creds, which sends us a one-time token. That token is sent from our server to our client. The client can then use that token inside to generate an iframe full of the credit card payment fields, which are hosted on Braintree. So because of that, even though we have SSL certificate and whatever, those credentials and everything like that, it's a secure context anyways, because it's inside of that iframe. And so we're passing that token to the iframe. The user enters their credentials. It sends their credit card information along with that token to Braintree to validate that that token is valid. It checks to make sure that they're authorized to process that the credit card with the amount and everything can complete that transaction. And if that transaction is able to be completed, it sends us back what's called a nonce, N-O-N-C-E. That nonce is then sent to our server via our API. Our server basically sends that nonce back to Braintree that says, charge this card, this amount, whatever. Use this nonce to process this payment. Braintree then says, all right, we have authorization. We know that the card can work. We have the nonce. Everything is checks out. We're charging this card. That sends us back a message that says either the charge was successful or it was not. Now, unfortunately, you don't get a ton of information if the charge was not successful. It's almost always like the card was declined. Okay. And users hate that because the user's like, the site's saying my card's declined. Why is my card declining? And I have to say, beats me, man. You gotta call your bank, which is the thing that everybody loves to do, is to dial up the phone number on the back of their credit card and call up their bank, right? And it could be the fact that we're a company based in the United States and they're processing a card from another country or something like that. Sometimes it's that, which is actually why we have PayPal on the site, because PayPal is much better about those things than credit cards are. Credit card can detect fraud for all sorts of reasons if you're in another country, but PayPal typically is really good about it because it's all connected to your account, right? So either way, if it's successful, it charges the credit card. So that's how that whole technical process works for subscriptions and for saving payments for later, right? You typically, you know, you work on Amazon or something, you buy something on Amazon and it saves your credit card. You know how it does that? And then you can use that card again without having to re-enter it. That's called vaulting. And what vaulting does is it's vaulting the credit card information on the payment processor. And what we're not doing is we're not storing any of your credit card information, any sensitive user information whatsoever. All we have is an ID, and that ID connects directly to a user account, which has then connected to a vault with those credit card numbers in them and everything like that. And even then, we can't access any of that information. That information is all sensitively stored on Braintree. So levelup.video never, ever sees your credit card payment, not even our server. Nothing ever sees it. Nothing ever sees the full digits of your credit card, just Braintree. Braintree is the only one who sees that, which is really great for us because the last thing I want to have to do is worry about having somebody's credit card number in my database. Like, I never want that to happen.
Yeah, or even... Not even on a database, but even like the possibility that it gets sent
to
your
server.
Like specifically, if you inspect Element on my checkout, there is no name inputs on all the sensitive form fields. Why? Because if for some reason JavaScript breaks and somebody submits that form to my server, it will post or get those variables to my server, and then that could potentially end up in a log somewhere, and it's just you don't want to touch that. So you literally have to say there's no possible way unless JavaScript is pulling it out of the input value.
And this is like, it's all good that this stuff works this easily now that you can just do an iframe drop into so many sites. Stripe has like the best drop in, the very best drop in.
Braintree
is fine, but it's not as good as Stripe's. So I think that's important because I've mentioned before in the show, we had a client one time, and when we first took over their site, their credit card payment was done when you entered the credit card information into the form on the website. It just sent the owner of the website an email with the full credit card number in plain text in an email. And then he manually typed that into his credit card machine. And it took so much effort for me to explain to him, like, why, one, that you can't do that. But two, like what, besides that being non-PCI compliant, and I think just straight up, I don't know if it's quote unquote illegal, but
it still happens to me way too often.
You get shut down.
You get a piece of paper and they tell you to write your credit card number on a paper, or you call them on the phone and they literally ask you for your credit card number, the expiry, and your billing address.
Even the bank does that if you're like doing a car payment or something.
Really?
Yeah,
that's wild. It's funny how strict we are on the web with this type of stuff. When like some intern that's working at like a flooring place can just ask for literally everything that could use to use your credit card.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, so that's how it is. Again, sensitive information. You got to be very sensitive about it. There's a whole thing called PCI compliance. Every single year, I have to resubmit our compliance documents to confirm that we're PCI compliant. And that should be a good thing for anybody who wants to shop on our website or any website that is using any of these services, right?
Next one is from Pork.
Pork. It's not pork. I know you would think it's pork because you like smoking pork.
I do like pork. I was going to say pourquoi. That's almost close to the French why. What is pork?
That's porque is why in Spanish.
Oh, okay. There we go. Why is this false? I'm a string instance of string. Let's see here. We'll pause it for a second and let me actually run it. So this one says, quote, I'm a string, end quote, instance of capital S string. And I believe the reason it does this is because if you do not create when you create a string literal, meaning you literally just open up and close quotes, that is creating a string literal. Another way to make a string is saying new capital S string, and then passing your string to that. And that is creating, I guess, like a class instance of the string versus a string literal. So that's why. I'm not sure why that would you would ever need that, because you should probably just use type of.
Yeah.
Is that right?
No, I just thought there was a... It's a funny question, and it almost could have been one of those, like, stumped questions.
Yeah, we
should
just stump
him in here specifically because I wanted you to answer this and like, see if you could do it. So, it's fun. This is like a...
Let's see if that's actually true before we publish this to the masses. Yeah, that's correct. So if you do new string and pass your string to it and say instance of string, that is true because you are using the new keyword there to create an instance of it, whereas a string literal is not an instance of capital S string because it was not created by the mama capital S string. It was created by a string literal. The same thing is true with numbers, booleans, and objects, I believe, yeah.
Love it. Love it. Next question is from Leha, says, do you use Mac spaces for organizing windows? If so, how do you group them? What about in the browser? Do you use tab groups? And I put this in here because this is something I started doing like January 1 of 2023. I started using spaces for the very first time in Mac OS. And I gotta say, hey man, spaces are pretty sweet. You know, there's some things that like I'd like to have open, like my calendar, where like if you minimize your calendar, it's not like super easy to just quickly get to it, or maybe email. There's things like that that I like to have open and non-minimized, and I've just been tossing them in spaces, and it really has been keeping my desktop clean. Another thing that I've been doing, Wes, this was of interest to you, is I have a space for recording now. So before, you know, I go to record a video, I got to move all my windows off the external desktop. I got to move things around. I got to reshuffle and get it like prepped for video. But now I just have a space that's always prepped for video, and it has like a VS Code and a terminal and whatever. It just sits there. If I want to use it, it's there. I don't have to like prep anything. So I started doing that. Another thing I started doing is with Arc. Arc browser allows you to do tab groups now, and those tab groups are like profiled tab groups. So you can now have a new tab group in Arc, or a new quote-unquote space in Arc. They call them spaces as well. And those can be set up to be specific profiles. So I do this now where I have one that's a logged out user for my site, and it has two bookmarks, the production version and the development version of the site, and it's just my site logged in and logged out. I have another one that is my site logged in and logged out as a subscribed user, and another one that's as an admin. So like for me to be able to now test my site and as a subscribed user or as a customer or as a non-user, I just have to go to that space, click on that bookmark or, you know, run the command palette to do it, and I'm loaded up. I don't have to log in. I don't have to go open a separate browser. I don't have to open an incognito window or something like that. It's just there for the taking. So this is something I have started doing, and I gotta say I really like it.
Oh, that's awesome. I haven't used spaces in a while. I used to use them a lot when I would do laptop only dev. And then I also, when I taught in person, I would use them a lot because I could quickly go between the notes and my like editor and my like the actual browser. But I don't because I have such a big screen, I almost never need that specific thing. I do use Firefox. What are they called in Firefox? Containers. The same thing as Scott is if you're trying to test being an admin and being a user, it's so annoying to have to sign in, sign out, or like create an incognito window and you have to sign in every single time. So much better just to have containers where one container will be a specific user. Another container could be a user with an affiliate account. Another container can be a user with like some sort of elevated permissions. And then the other one is me, the admin. I can see everything. And so much easier than having to do that type of thing.
Yeah, totally.
You tweeted last night that Arc is working on a mobile browser. That's been my one hang up from moving over, is I just want my history synced from my phone to my computer.
Yeah, I think they said spring. In fact, today they shared their TikTok that actually shows screenshots of it in
really
action. So I think it's relatively close, which that's very exciting to me.
Yeah, I'm into that. I've also been considering just going straight up Safari because of the like plugin extensions in Safari. But I want to sync everything. And like Safari on I don't know if it's just me, but like Safari on the desktop, the dev tools are just like so lacking. Yeah, they're not like they're garbage, but like,
yeah, I'm sorry.
They're just not as they're just like they're probably like 82% there. And they're just random stuff. Like on my website, I use style components and style components like updates the style tag. And like when that happens, you can't edit the style on Safari, but you can on literally every other browser. There's just so much little stuff.
Some weird like disconnected from the DOM error or something that Safari has all the time.
Yeah.
And you know what? Also, another thing about Safari is the longer you use it, there becomes, I don't know about the laptop, because I actually use, or mobile, I use Safari primarily on my iPad and my phone, right? But on desktop, the longer you use it and the bigger your history gets, there becomes a distinct latency when you start typing in the address bar. You hit a key and it's only a couple of milliseconds or whatever, but it's enough that it really sends me. Like, I'm trying to be more positive now. And like, man, there's nothing that I'm just like, this latency is literally making me insane. It is ruining my life. And which sounds so stupid. It's a total baby behavior on my part, but it does. It makes me upset. And because of that, I just can't use Safari for desktop. And it's been that way forever. Nobody seems to care. That's fine.
Next one from Sean. Do you have any tips that would help my front end team avoid rendering a DOM with invalid element nesting? I've become pedantic PR reviewer who says things like you can't put a button inside of a hyperlink or you can't put a div inside of a label. We are building a large app with hundreds of components and the encapsulation we get from components is great, but it also obscures HTML content categories, making it hard to see that some components should not be nested inside of other components. Oh, that's interesting. We are using Svelte, but I think this is the same problem with the previous team on Vue. Do you have some tooling you know that could help? Or should I stop being pedantic, especially when it comes to rules that don't affect usability or accessibility, like nesting a div inside of a paragraph? That's a good one. I think the ones that do matter, for me in React land, the JSX A11Y accessibility plugin for ESLint catches a lot of those where, and those are all accessibility based, but they do catch a lot of those. Oh shoot, I shouldn't have done that type of thing. But like, can you not put a div inside of a paragraph? You probably shouldn't, but I'm pretty sure with HTML5, a lot of those like rules kind of went out the window.
If you're putting anything inside of a, you should use a span.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
because that's what it's there for. There, Svelte does have ally tools as well to do that, and they catch any issues like that I have. Another thing, you know, if you have, DOM nesting errors, the PageSpeed stuff will catch all that, the Lighthouse tools. So
oh,
if
yeah.
you're running those, it should be able to catch those for you.
It kind of has to be on rendered because, like, how do you
yeah,
know?
Right. Yeah. Inside of the component flow.
And that kind of sucks because like then you have to run that check as like part of the PR. And at that, it's nicer to have it as a linting error where you yeah. write it. And like you could like define a component child to never be another type of component. Cause so there's that, but then there's also just like straight up HTML nesting. And like, that was what the HTML validator was for so many years later. Like what is the equivalent of that in the editor? There's got to be a HTML. Let me see this. I'm very interested now because the reason I don't know this is because I don't write a ton of straight up HTML. Most of my HTML is in Svelte like that, you know? So I would think you reach for some sort of HTML validator package. So to answer your question, I don't know, but now I'm very curious because that definitely should exist. So I'm sure somebody out there will have a tool that will go along with your prettier and ESLint in your VS Code.
Totes. Next question from Brian. Would you do an episode commenting on the CSS nesting survey release this week? I know you did nesting back in 2021, but curious to see your opinions. So I don't think we need to do a whole episode on this, but basically CSS is getting nesting, which is something that is fantastic. You know, we all use preprocessors or post CSS to have nesting because it's one of those things that just really reduces how much you have to type overall. The big problem is that you can't get CSS preprocessor style nesting in CSS because it doesn't work with the CSS parser. There are some very technical reasons for why that is. And I'm not going to get into it right now. So maybe that would be worth an episode, but I just don't know if it's valuable enough to say we don't get it because it can't work that way. So because of that, you either have to have a number of these different various syntaxes. So we could look at these, Wes, maybe in another episode, like a hasty, and like talk about which one's our favorite. But at the end of the day, I think what really, the one that I would pick is the one that looks the most like SAS style, just as close as possible. And what I think of that as is being the one that you just use the ampersand every single time you want to nest something.
Yeah, yeah.
And right now I have a PostCSS plugin that makes my nesting work just like SAS does. And maybe that's just what I'm going to keep using forever. So I really don't know, because I just don't want anything other than the CSS or the SAS style nesting. And you know, I can't vote for that because it won't exist. So
yeah. I think the ampersand. So what Scott said is you can't just write a selector inside of another selector. It won't work. So I think the best solution they have now is the fact that you could just write ampersand and another selector, and then you can just nest it in. That's what I've been using so far with a couple PostCSS plugins. I haven't gone full cook on that just yet because it's not done. And I certainly have gotten bit by that in the past. So I'm just waiting for the one to be chosen. But I think that the ampersand one is the one that's got to move. There's a couple other, you should look at this link that we have in the show notes, because there's a couple other where you can like, it almost looks like TypeScript extending a type where you have
there's a lot curly of brackets ones,
after. Yeah. But also, I'm not going to be too wild about it because I thought the variable syntax was so silly, and now I'm totally fine with it. So it'll be okay.
Yeah, I know. It is. It's shocking how much my opinion has changed on that. I went from being like, I really don't like this CSS variable syntax to one, it's not a big deal, and two, it's really nice, and your variables are all explicit. Maybe that's just something, you know, I tweeted out that as I get older, I like longer variable names and stuff. And maybe that's just it. The more mature I get, the more I see the benefit in having things be explicit. I mean, heck, I used to really love what were called transparent variables in Stylus, where like in Stylus, a variable was just a word. There was no indicator that it was a variable, which was really neat for design systems.
You could overwrite. I still have it in my own code base. I overwrote yellow. It's the best. I never want the default yellow.
Right. That's what I did, is I just overwrote the color. So instead of having a variable yellow, you just have a new named yellow. And I really liked that at the time. And maybe I still would really like that. But
I definitely see why, though, why it's not a good idea.
Yeah, totally.
There's a lot of magic in there. I was writing a custom MongoDB query the other day. I use Mongoose. And in the past, I would have just extended the Mongoose model to put custom methods on it. And that definitely has its own valid use cases because you can chain them and whatnot. But sometimes I just want a function that just says, like, in my case, it was increment coupon uses by one. And I was like, I'm not going to put that on the Mongoose model. I'm just going to make a function that I pass in a value. And I was just like, man, just functions are great, you know?
I do that all the time. I got one that is get courses with authors, and it just, all it does is run an aggregation. Like, that's it, but it's explicit.
I'm actually thinking that over right now in my course platform. I have a lot of middleware that does things like when you visit the website, before it renders the page, it puts the course code, the product code, the user. It puts all of that stuff on the request so that later requests can access that via like request.user or request.couponcode or request.courseCode. And then I'm thinking about, okay, well, I want to move this thing to serverless, and the whole middleware thing is not as big in the serverless space. So I was thinking like, maybe those don't need to be middlewares. Maybe they just need to be functions, you know, pass in the request, get that data back.
Yeah. I'm just trying to function. Remember that one? That was a good.
How do you go about prioritizing your work? I find myself distracted by different topics in web development, and before you know it, I'm behind on my work. I even get distracted by lower priority tasks, which are easier than my higher priority tasks. I figure since you're both releasing awesome courses and doing this fantastic podcast regularly, you have prioritization down. It's funny that you say that, because we are recording this podcast right now.
The day before it's released.
The day before it's released because we goofed up. Apologies to Chris for doing that. Usually we're a week or two ahead. I'd love to hear your process. So I put everything into my Things app, which is what I need to do. And generally, I have like a good idea of what needs to get done in a day. And I'll just write down, I'll drag the things that need to get done out of their like projects into today. And then I just bump them up and down and reorder them. I definitely still do get distracted and go on little tangents. But I allow myself that because that's part of my job of being someone who is constantly curious and checking things out and whatnot. But if I don't do that, I find myself just like, oh, I need to do this. I need to do this. Like yesterday I had 6 or 7 different things. And I simply just had to say, okay, stop, Wes, go to your things, bubble them up and down into an order, and then do the first thing first, do the next thing next. And I was actually thinking about that is we maybe should even have a podcast on this because the concept of do the next thing next is very calming because I'm working on my workshop right now and I'm overwhelmed with there's probably 15 different things I would like to do. And I always have to tell myself, do the next thing next. Like, of course, there's lots of work to be done, but you just have to do the next thing next.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this just now and what really hit me is that like let's say there's like 8 fires around. And if you're just running around like, oh, we've got to do this one, then got to do this one, then got to do this one, whatever. You're just trying to put them out. You're not taking a look at like the big picture of like what the efficient way to handle any sort of situation is. And you very well may be like running around forever, just back and forth and back and forth. And like Courtney and I used to play this video game a whole lot that was like cooking. And you had these little characters, Overcooked as the game is. I talked about it on the show a while ago. And it was so much fun. But there was a distinct order. And what would happen is when things got really crazy, you know, there's too much food coming out and you're not cooking it. You have to like pass tasks back and forth. If you didn't have your system down before then, you're just like trying to stay alive. You're just doing this and that and this and that and this and that. And at the end, you failed typically. And when it works is when you have a system from the start and you really follow that system and you don't lose track of that system. So for me, you know, I give myself time to explore. I put it into my calendar. Here's some time to explore. And it's easy if you budget that time to explore to look at that and say, hey, I got 5 minutes or 15 or 20 or an hour to explore 2 hours from now. I'll do this then. But for now, my task list shows me that this is what I have to do. So I do a fairly common system and I do it in height.app. You use Things. It's probably very similar. It's just a to-do list. But I have every single task I have to do for the website. That's typically what I do, or even my day-to-day. Anytime anything goes into Things or height, it gets a points value. And a points value is kind of it's not random, but it's like a value that expresses how much effort this is going to take. It's not correlated to hours or time or anything. It's purely, this is a big effort or this is a small effort. 1 is a small effort, 8 is a big effort. And then I have a high, medium, and low priority. And then what I have my to-do app do is it gives me everything first and foremost by due date. So if it has a high due date, then it gets to the top of the list. The next thing that will put it up to the top of the list is a high priority value high priority value. And then it's further sorted by points value. So the easiest, highest priority things that are due today are at the top of my list. And I just go by that list. What do I got to do? What's at the top of my list? All right, this is it.
Do that
and I can
next,
reevaluate that list, but it rules. It's good. I don't have to think about it. And that's the best part. Because if I have to think about it, I'm doing too many other things or not doing anything.
Yeah, it's one of those two.
Yeah, we should do a whole episode on this. We could do it. I could talk about it forever.
Totally. I would like to do that. All right, let's get into sick picks. You got a sick pick for me today, Scott?
Do I have a sick pick? Of course I do, Wes. Let me tell you a little life hack. You know what's really great? Taking a nice hot shower with dried eucalyptus hanging from your shower. That thing is awesome. I saw somebody do this on Instagram, like a wellness person, and like, man, what I did is I bought dried eucalyptus from Amazon. You can buy it from anywhere. You can buy it from Trader Joe's or literally anywhere. But I bought a big old bundle of it from Amazon, and it comes with a little rope, and you just tie it upside down. And I tied it from my shower head upside down. And what happens is, you know, when the steam from the shower gets cooking, man, it's awesome. It just smells so super fragrant and nice. It makes your whole bathroom smell nice. And because it's just straight up dried eucalyptus, you're not using oils that are going to get things messy and grubby or anything. You're not, you know, it's not like in a soap or anything. It's not getting on you even though I like eucalyptus. But it smells wonderful. And it's such a nice little life hack. It's super easy. It's cheap to buy. And man, totally rules.
I'm going to sick pick a recycling bin hanging bracket. So I'm all about in this new house minor updates that make you go, oh, that's nice. Because like, honestly, that's what I'm all about. It's just like tiny little things, obviously big things, but tiny little things that make life a little bit easier. So in our new house, we have to throw something in the recycling bins. You have you go to the mudroom, you open the door to the garage, and then you throw the can or the piece of paper or the box into the recycling. And what I did is I hung them on the wall so that we can put other recycling bins underneath it. So we have four recycling bins, and I hung two of them on the wall with these new hanging brackets. And it makes it so much easier to throw something out because you're not at the top of the stairs for the garage hucking it. You just reach over and put it in really, really nicely. And this is one of those things where I just wish I had a 3D printer for it, because it was like $22 for just a little plastic molded clip. But man, was it worth it? Let me tell you, you could put your, do you guys have green bins as well in Colorado where you throw your like food scraps?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to pay for them. Isn't that messed up? Yeah.
Oh no. No, not in here.
We pay for one. We fill them up.
That's good. Yeah, you can hang your green bin on it as well. I don't do that just because ours gets maybe a bit too heavy for that, but it works super well. Green bin holder. You got to figure out like who makes your blue bin and find the like corresponding one, and it works. At our old house, I made one out of wood, and it didn't work as well. So I'm very happy with this one.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a life hack. I'm doing the same thing, whether that's that little label printer I sick picked a while ago.
Yeah.
We bought a bunch of those clear plastic tubs from from Costco, did all the labels. And it was just yesterday, Courtney was like, man, I went to go put something away in the basement, and there was a labeled bin for it, and it just went right in the bin, and I needed something else, and there was a cable. I needed a cable for the kids, and it was labeled exactly in a nice little bin. And I got to say, you did a great job, or whatever she said. I forget what it is, but she praised me for it. It was lovely.
That's good.
Yeah, it was great.
Life's all about those tiny little updates, because when you got enough going on in your life, like you don't want to have to do it, or you just can't find the freaking thing, or something's in a... Like, I don't know, like I always talk to my wife about things that are not done properly. Like I talk to her for me. She's like, why do you care about the blue bins? I was like, well,
yeah,
that's going to cause another issue down the line. Someone's going to trip on it, or there's not going to be enough room for the kids' bikes, and they're going to get annoyed and things like that. And as if you can spend 36 minutes of my evening fixing this, now for the rest of my life, or at least for the foreseeable future, this will never be a problem. And if you do that 100 times a year, your life will be very good.
I love optimizations. That's one of the reasons why that Marie Kondo show really spoke to me. It wasn't about like the getting rid of stuff, which sure, fine. Yeah, that's great. But man, developing systems and organizing and like that rules. I'm very, very into it. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So let's shamelessly plug. I'm going to shamelessly plug levelup.video. This is our learning site. And in fact, we're releasing a new course this month on Svelte and TypeScript. We're going to be talking about everything you need to know to not only write your Svelte to be TypeScript safe, but also your Svelte kit code. So it's going to be broken up into two sections, Svelte kit and then Svelte. We're going to be doing all the commonly used TypeScript tasks. And I should know, I have a big old site written in Svelte and TypeScript. I have encountered just about everything you need to know there, whether that is, custom actions, or maybe you have what are called the events, event dispatching in Svelte. We can type all that. You can have all of your state, your complex state management fully typed, or anything coming from your server or working with forms. It's really incredible. So levelup.video, if you're interested in learning about Svelte, SvelteKit, TypeScript, or all so much more, we even have a ton of actual CSS content coming up.
Shamelessly plug all my courses. Go to westboss.com/courses to get a list of all of them. You can use coupon code for syntax for $10 off. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Catch you on Friday.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.